Hello, I'm Bruce Celery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. Do you want the best for your children? Of course you do. And this may include wanting to help them with their financial situation. But if you're someone who removes every financial obstacle for them and helps to pay for some bills, you might be a snowplow parent. It's a thing. This can be an issue for both your pocketbook and your parenting. Certified financial planner Teresa Bailey is here to talk more about what this term means and whether or not it should fit for you. Leading a team is not easy, but one thing that can help you in surprising ways is something called improv. You've probably seen it on TV, like improv comedy. Tracy Shea Porter, CEO and co-founder of Yes Unlimited, explains how this can work and talks about her new book, focused on organizations. It's called Yes And, Improv Skills for Leadership and Life. And what you can learn about someone by digging through their purse. A lot, according to Lindsay Stanbury. She's the founder of The Purse, a site dedicated to women and personal finance. She's here to talk about that. Plus, I'll speak with Daniel Bernhardt, CEO of the Institute for Canadian Citizenship, about something called the Canoe Access Pass. It's an app for newcomers that helps them explore culture in this country, oftentimes for free. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple, brought to you in part by Credit Canada, the first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country. Let's get started. So early in my career, I registered for this class at Second City, the training school connected to the comedy troupe. And I went because it was going to be this super fun activity that I was doing with a friend. And for sure it was that. However, it also built some skills for me, in me, that were incredibly relevant throughout my entire career. Much more helpful than I ever would have thought. And I know my next guest would agree on the benefits of improv training because she's written a book on it. Tracy Shea Porter is the CEO and co-founder of Yes Unlimited. She is also the author of the book, Yes and Business Evolution, Improv Skills for Leadership and Life. She joins us now. Hello there.
Bruce, it's a pleasure to be with you today.
I saw the title of your book, and I immediately knew we were going to have to talk because I am such a big believer in the principles of improv and Yes And in particular. I think we should start there. What do those two words jammed together actually mean?
Yes And. Yes. Okay. Well, the first thing I want to ask you, I'm going to dig into Yes And, Bruce. When you think of comedy, and when maybe some of your listeners think of comedy, throw some words at me. What does it mean to you?
Freedom, yeah. Laughter, whimsy, right. Playfulness, community, sore belly.
I love all that. And it's all true, right? And a lot of people listening might think improv is about performance and stand-up and, you know, people who are doing sketch comedy, and all that's true. And Yes And is a foundation principle from that, you know, kind of modality. And what we're talking about today is something called applied improvisation. So we're taking the skills from improv and we apply them to other things like corporate training, even therapeutic work, helping people overcome anxiety, all kinds of things. So Yes And, what Yes And, that foundation principle that comedy troupes use so well, which really helps them have back and forth conversations where they apply active listening and letting go of judgment. And so, for example, Yes And is, you know, yes, I'm listening to you. I hear you. I may not even agree with you. And that's one of the important points. I might not agree with you. That's okay. I'm actually suspending my judgment out of respect. And we're going to go back and forth. I'll listen to you. And then you'll listen to me. And you'll give me that same respect. And these Yes And conversations might help us hear something new because we're listening and hearing each other and arrive at something completely new together.
Watching comedy and improv comedy before you know what Yes And is all about, you really can only know that it's hilarious. But tell me about what happens in a scene in which no is what comes back at the other performer. Like, there's no comedy there. Why is there no comedy there?
Right. So no, what happens when you use the word no, sometimes no can be a yes. We'll talk about that nuance in a second. Frequently, no is a block. You know, and if you're in the corporate world, for example, and you hear a lot of no, studies even show it shuts down the brain and you stop participating. So I write a lot in the book about the toxic use of no. For example, I had a no guy I was working with a couple of years ago. He was an entrepreneur. And every time I saw him, he was saying no, yelling no to his team. And they were all walking around with their, you know, they had no mojo left. They were totally out of it. They weren't engaged. They weren't engaged, Bruce. And they were kind of listless from hearing all that no, because it's blocking you from feeling like you're a part of the team. Like there's no camaraderie here when all that you really hear is no. So the yes and bringing that kind of training into the corporate life and helping leaders in particular understand the value of yes and how a team and themselves can be motivated and build trust by saying, hey, I hear you, and we're gonna listen to your ideas. In fact, active listening is one of the main ingredients of improv and yes and.
One of the things you must have to deal with is, I don't know the right way to phrase it, but interrupting the human thing, especially in organizations, to bring the past and to bring your data and to bring the time it didn't work before. There's lots of reasons why we say no, and we're bringing that to sessions in which we're talking about the future and brainstorming. How do you help people short circuit their predisposition to say, you know, you're great, we tried that, it doesn't work?
Right, exactly. And that's one of the, you're so right. It's one of the things that holds people back from innovation and holds companies back from creativity and trying something new is that kind of, that block of that, no, it's not going to work kind of thing. So it's actually, improv trains the brain. And there's a lot of research out there now. It actually trains the brain to be more divergent in the thinking. So what we actually go in and work with leaders and say, hey, let's focus on divergent thinking with intention. So you have to have an intentionality about it and say, we're going to have a brainstorming afternoon or day or session where we apply this divergent thinking, which means all ideas are good ideas. Mm. All ideas are good ideas. Everyone can be heard.
I was in a brainstorming session about a year ago where we talked about yes and as a brainstorm rule, to use air quotes. And what was interesting was the extent to which one individual in particular was offended by having others kind of point out that it was a no, but instead of a yes. And how do you try and normalize that we're having a bit of a different conversation than you may be used to having?
It's a really good point, because how you set up what you're going to do and debrief around the different exercises that you do is really important. So you don't just walk in and say, we're going to yes and. You actually have to go in and say, okay, let's talk about what this is going to mean to your organization and the value of it. And by the way, with improv, mistakes are kind of where the magic happens. And we try to highlight the fact that it's good to embrace all your mistakes as a learning and growth opportunity. And we, every time someone could say, but for example, go cheer, woo, you did it, you said it, you know? And so we could set it up that way where it's celebrated. And when you celebrate that, those little failures, it helps people feel like, oh, if I make a mistake, it's not the end of the world in the office. Whereas people frequently don't speak up. I'm actually brought in a lot of times to help teams with confidence and speaking up. And often it's because the leadership team and the way the organization is arranged, they haven't really created that kind of space for employees to feel like they can speak up.
How do you address what I think in many organizations would be a concern, that I don't want to do improv training. I'm not funny. I don't want to be a stand-up comic. This is like, just the notion of having to be on the spot like that is very stressful. How do you address that?
I love that question. And in a way, it's the way I started the conversation with you, is we start by saying, what do you think comedy is? And we get all that right out on the table. And by the way, what we're doing is using some of the foundation principles of improv and applying it to something different. You're not, all you really need to do is be yourself when you're doing applied improv techniques. And we make people feel really comfortable and say, the, you know, please, all the mistakes are great. We're gonna clap and cheer when you make an error and that sort of thing, because we want this. I call this a low stakes way to get ready for high stakes things.
Mm. If I was a fly on the wall in one of your training programs, yeah. I would see a group of people. I'd be in a conference room or a board room. I don't know if you are doing this seated or if you go into a circle. What would I see? What kinds of things would you do?
Okay, well, if we have small groups under 30, we would put everyone would be in a circle standing because it's very dynamic. And we would do exercises in a circle, really well facilitated. We have a great team of facilitators. And if it's a large crowd, sometimes we work with 200 people. Wow. And in that scenario, we probably have two of us or even two to four of us at the front of the room, maybe on a stage, and we bring up volunteers. And we've done this with hundreds of people, Bruce, and there's always volunteers there. And one thing you can guarantee when you're doing this, you're going to be laughing. You're going to be laughing. And Bruce, what about it? What if I just do a short improv exercise with you right now?
Oh my God, very I'm short. So intimidated. I couldn't possibly be put on the spot like that. I'm so nervous. I'm perspiring here. Of course, I'm
I
ready.
I love it. Yes, let's and. Do it. Okay, okay. We're going to, for the audience, I'd love to do a very quick butt exercise, no exercise, and then yes and, to show what you've been talking about so well, the difference between no and yes and in this kind of situation where you want teams to be open. So what I'll do is I'll say one sentence, and you'll respond to my sentence starting with the word no, and then I'll start my sentence with no, and we'll go back, and I'll end the scene in a okay. short period of time. So I'll say, start with, Mary went to the store to buy groceries.
No, she went to the store to get a knife because she was going to operate on her own hand.
No, she actually got into her spaceship and traveled to Mars.
No, she didn't go to Mars because she knew she had an appointment with her therapist on Tuesday and Mars is too far to get back in time.
No, she went to get a manicure and pedicure because she had a date that night.
No, she didn't. She's married.
Okay, we'll end there. So what did we find out about that lady by going back and forth in that way?
Well, she's got a very interesting life.
Right.
Really interesting.
Really interesting. And nothing really connects, right?
Yeah.
Nothing really happens because there's no acceptance of each other's ideas.
Yeah.
Right? And all we do is like from one kind of throwing something at the wall. It's like throwing things at the wall without any kind of agreement whatsoever. Yes. Yeah, yeah. So let's try that again with yes and.
Okay.
And I'll start it and then you'll start your sentence with yes and. Okay.
Okay.
Mary went to the office and wore her favorite coat.
Yes, and she loved this coat more than anything because it came to her as a present from Celine Dion.
Yes, and she was so excited as she got into her car because she was going to meet Celine Dion for lunch.
And yes, and Celine Dion always ordered the same thing. People think she's a light eater, but she loves a Reuben sandwich.
Yes, and Mary had ordered the Reuben sandwich ahead of time. So as she got out of her car and went into the restaurant, she saw Celine Dion was so excited. She had the sandwich in front of her.
Yes, and what was so beautiful was she was eating the sandwich and also singing My Heart Will Go On at the very same time. It was beautiful. And someone was rolling on their phone and they uploaded the video to TikTok and it already has 10 million views.
Yes, and they got together and had the best lunch ever and laughed and uploaded videos all day.
So good.
There we go. There's yes and. So what do we know about the scene now?
Well, it's got a beginning, middle, and an end. There's characters, there's personality. It was fun to do.
Exactly. So the power of yes and, I always say the exercises are the teachers. And in a way, when you do it, you realize, oh, this is not so difficult. I don't have to be a stand-up comic. We're doing simple exercises that have deep and profound help and really help people develop skills.
Right. The book is called Yes and Business Evolution, Improv Skills for Leadership and Life. Tracy, thank you for joining us today.
Bruce, it's been a pleasure.
Tracy Shea Porter. Coming up next on Moolala, Teresa J.W. Bailey, certified financial planner. She's going to be here to talk about snowplow parenting and what it might mean for your retirement plans if you just bought your kid a house. And later, an app for newcomers called the Canoe Access Pass. Great way to engage newcomers to Canada in this culture, but also a way to get them out doing some stuff for free. I'll talk to Daniel Bernard, CEO of the Institute for Canadian Citizenship. And if you want to get inspired to get a better handle on your money, sign up for the Moolala newsletter. You receive simple financial advice. We send like 4 or 5 links every single month. It only comes once a month. And it's all the stuff that we do here on SiriusXM, CBC Radio, CityLine, BNN Bloomberg. Go to moolala.ca to sign up for that newsletter. And we will never do anything with your address other than send you that thing once a month. Moolala Money Made Simple is brought to you in part by Credit Canada. I am the CEO of the organization, and we are Canada's longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency. Our mission is to help people get out of debt so they can get back into life. Listen, debt is a brutal reality for millions of Canadians. It starts to pile on for lots and lots of different reasons: job loss, divorce, illness, bad luck, you name it. Our accredited credit counselors are available to help you understand your current financial situation and take you through all your options on how to move forward. And there really are options out there. So go to creditcanada.com. We are nonprofit, as I said. The counseling is free and judgment free. If you are a parent, you for sure know that the financial world that your kids are growing up in is different from the one that you experienced when you left the nest. It's just different today than it was before. Many parents, because of the ridiculous cost of living, the ridiculous cost of housing, are getting much more engaged in the financial lives of their children. And there's actually a new phrase for this, which I hadn't heard of. It is called the snowplow parent. The idea being that you kind of push these obstacles out of the way for your kids. Good thing, bad thing. We're going to talk about the idea and maybe some of the pros and cons. Our guest is Teresa J.W. Bailey. She is a certified financial planner and president of the Nashville office at Waddell & Associates. She joins us from Nashville, Tennessee today. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce. Thank you for having me.
I had not heard this term. What does this term snowplow parents actually mean?
Well, I think it really has come into popular conversation lately because so many children are either boomeranging back, which we've heard that term for a long time, or staying in the family home much, much longer. And there has been a movement towards sort of snowplowing all of life's troubles out of the way and making things much easier, which interestingly enough could be because maybe this generation of parents feels like they had it too hard, or this generation of children maybe also has it too hard. Who knows where it's coming from?
There are certain places where I completely get it. I live in Toronto. The price of a house here is ridiculous. And we know that many, many families whose the parents can afford it are underwriting a down payment on a home. But when you talk about this term, it sounds like pushing the obstacles away can go even further than this. What are some things that you've heard of in your experience or with your clients, actions that parents are taking that maybe they would not have taken a generation ago?
I see an interesting trend where we're doing financial planning, and previously in the start of the financial planning process, we planned for expenses for children to drop off after college. So I'm helping, and then there's a cliff. Now, especially in the older sort of early 50s generation, now there's a desire to help with the grandchildren, the very young grandchildren, the daycare costs, maybe the young private schools. So where we assumed there would be a drop in expenses and maybe a catch up in saving for their own retirement, they're lengthening that help after college to include the next generation as well.
You, I am sure, have to sometimes check your own parenting advice or morality at the door and listen to what your clients actually want. What are some of the things that you would at least listen for, if not speak to, but listen for in terms of the cons of this type of approach, snowplow parenting?
Yeah, I think I'm really listening to what's the reason they're helping, right? I think if it's general fulfillment of, I would rather spend money on those I love now where I can see them enjoy it. That's something that, okay, we're going to work really hard and make this work short-term and long-term for you. If it is a, you know, need to connect or a fear of something that also leaves, you know, my client in a position to be less financially safe in their future, then, you know, we've really got to dial back. And, you know, it's the whole airplane conversation of you've got to put your own oxygen mask on first before you help others around you.
How do you help people think that through in a way that is tangible and visceral, but also gives them what they may want to make a difference for this next generation? I mean, that's a tough conversation to have to say, listen, I get it. You want to contribute to the down payment. You may not be able to afford long-term care in your old age.
That's where the financial planning process and actually looking at, you know, cash flow year over year from the current age through age 90. It's really difficult to look at a mountain chart that's falling off a cliff and you're running out of money at age 75 and not really think seriously about, okay, can I really afford this $30,000 lump sum to help my child now? If it means I'm going to be looking to them to cash flow my nursing home care down the road.
I am sure you have a good amount of exposure to that next generation. Either you've met them directly, maybe some of them are even your clients. There are pros and cons to parents engaging in the financial lives of their children, but one of the cons can be a delay at the time in which they learn the things that they really need to know in order to be financially independent. Weigh in on that notion. Am I making it too big a deal?
Oh, for them to get involved, you know, it's, you know, the school of hard knocks, right? Yeah. Like so many of us learn from experience. And I think there is something to be said for if, you know, children in their late 20s, especially in early 30s, who are nesting at home very comfortably and being helped, you know, there's not the eating ramen noodles, how do I make this work? Panic about your
children. Clearly, we were born in the same year and went to college at the same time, because I know exactly what you're talking about.
I mean, I became a financial advisor because I lost my scholarship. And I thought, well, I should probably learn about money because I'm about to take on a lot of debt. Because I had a hard knocks dad who said, you know, that maybe wasn't a wise decision. You're on your own, kid.
Wow. That is kind of harsh when you put it that way. Do you wish that he had been a snowplow parent for you?
No, I love my career. It worked out really, really well for me, really well. And he was a single dad. Everybody has their own experience. I'm certainly grateful that I was placed, you know, into the frying pan, as they say, and I had to figure out how to deal with it all. But I have a daughter. I'm very compassionate towards not wanting to see your children suffer. Nobody wants that. But if you have a capable child who can get out there on their own and you maybe haven't saved enough for your later years, you know, some tough love could be in order there.
What role do you think parents have in terms of, sure, they may cut the check on some of these expenses or the down payment, but you would hope that a part of that, or that wouldn't exclude the wisdom that they have gleaned through their own life experience on how to do these sorts of things.
Meaning, what is the role parents have in teaching their children about financial acumen?
That's it.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, you know, it's interesting. A lot of my clients reach out to me for me stepping in to help them provide that advice because it's so different when our parents tell us to do something that's a good habit or something that's better from us. But when it comes from a professional or an outside source, it just carries a different weight. You know, some of us maybe had parents where we thought they were always right and we always did what they asked. Most of us, though, I think it was very different. Very, very different. So instilling good financial habits, you know, a lot of it can be observed at the kitchen table or your office, what your children have seen. But I do think that there has to be some intentionality as young adults transition into having their own, you know, personal bookkeeping and investment decision.
What have you noticed about strings? So as you have clients who have decided to be snowplowed, decided to provide money for their kids, have there been pitfalls? Have they got wrapped up in the web of a relationship dynamic that isn't super healthy for either party?
Yeah, I see that, you know, strings are definitely attached in many, many situations. You know, I think it kind of starts out with the cell phone bill. Like, well, if I keep paying their cell phone bill, then, you know, they're going to call me. Yeah. Money
I
is
get that. I have
motivator.
A 14-year-old. I'll probably pay their cell phone bill forever just so they'll call me.
Yeah. Yep. So, you know, you get into that and then house down payment. Where it gets funky is, in my opinion, when you're helping your adult child who is then married and there are so many other players that are entering the conversation. And then it's almost like you're dipping your toe into a marital relationship. And there's a lot of friction that can come from that. Because when a parent's trying to retain control of their child's behavior, who now has a spouse, I mean, that's just a lot of uncomfortable moments ahead.
An impossible question, but what advice would you have on helping a client determine what the cutoff should be, either life stage or age? I know it differs for everybody.
Oh, yeah. I think this is when a good coach or therapist can come into play to help you. No, I'm not even
Did you
even
just
kidding.
Absolve yourself of responsibility here that with that last tough question?
Family dynamics it's so much a part of financial planning. There are some financial advisors that can help you get to that answer, but I think, you know, It's a delicate balance. You have to understand, you have to know thyself and know thy child. And that's a big ask.
Yeah. Maybe I'll be a snow shoveler versus this, like just a little around the deck. I'll do the deck and that's about it.
I think
Thank you for joining us. It's a great topic and there's tough calls for parents out there. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Bruce.
Teresa J.W. Bailey is a certified financial planner. She is also the president of the Nashville office of Waddell & Associates. She was here to talk about snowplow parenting.
Hi, it's me, your dad. Look, we need to talk. This isn't working. The missed payments, the collection calls, and all those sleepless nights. We need nonprofit debt counseling, and I found the perfect place. Credit Canada Debt Solutions. They're non-judgmental, 100% confidential. They'll negotiate with creditors and even stop interest. Don't you want to rebuild your credit? You deserve better.
Break up with debt. Visit creditcanada.com.
Our next guest says that you can learn a whole lot about someone from digging through their handbag. But like, when would you actually have an excuse to do that in a socially appropriate way? Lindsay Stanbury does. She is a freelance writer, editor, content strategist, and founder of The Purse, a site dedicated to women and personal finance. She's also running this in her Purse series, which I think is fascinating. She joins us now from Brooklyn, New York. Hello, Lindsay.
Hi, Bruce. So nice to be here today.
Why did you decide to start The Purse, and in particular, this series that we're going to talk about, In Her Purse?
Yeah, I started The Purse last summer. I've worked in journalism for a long time and have run a few different personal finance websites. but I was sort of feeling like there wasn't any great site out there talking to sort of women in their middle age about their finances. You know, it was a lot of, it was like really basic information about like saving up for an emergency fund or why should you have a 401k? But I felt like women in their 30s, 40s, 50s, you know, had a lot more bigger money issues that needed to be addressed. And so that was the idea behind the purse. And then I started In Her Purse, which is a series where I talk to women and go through their handbags, because I knew a lot of really interesting women and I wanted to figure out how to feature them in kind of a casual and fun way and get a little sense of their personality. And like you said, it's not usually socially acceptable to dig through someone's handbag, but it can be kind of interesting when you do. So it felt like a fun way to get more women's stories told on the purse.
How did your subjects receive this request? Were they like, oh yeah, totally? Or did they say, okay, I'm willing, but I need to edit the contents first?
So there may definitely be some editing that goes on. The first one we ran, one of the comments was like, how does this person not have any like lint and dirty mints and crumpled receipts? And so I do think to some extent, it's a little bit cleaned up.
Right.
But they were excited. The first woman I featured was Heather Bonaparte, who is, you know, one of those wonderful internet friends. Like we found each other serendipitously and she's just really fun. And she's working on a book about couples and money, which I think is really interesting. And she was really excited to open up her purse. And she had just been to the theater with her daughter, and that had been a really special experience. That she was still carrying around the Wicked playbill, which I think, you know, is like a perfect example of the things we carry in our purse.
What are some things that have surprised you? And as a man, my man purse has three things in it: my wallet, my glasses, and my phone. My best friend, who's a female, carries steel chopsticks in her purse.
Oh, like, I love that.
Yeah, it's great, but I can't even imagine it. What are some things that people have hauled out that you've been like, what?
Yeah, I had a friend when she was potty training her toddler, and she pulled out a pair of training undies, a backup pair, which I think is sums up motherhood in many ways. I used to always find my son, when he was younger, was a really big Hot Wheels fan. And so I always had Hot Wheels in my purse, inevitably. One thing that Heather mentioned on hers, she had these really funky keychains that some sayings on them that were important to her, that she had left over from her corporate lawyer days. Mm. And I think that they're, you know, purses are very utilitarian, but at the same time, they often are a reflection of our, like, our personality and our style. And so I think it's often fun to see those kind of little details that mean a lot to you personally, but wouldn't necessarily send a big message to the outside world.
I don't want to stretch too far here, but what are some things that you learn, or even the subject can learn, about the relationship to money based on what they haul around all the time? And my hypothesis would be that someone who has a purse that has like an item for every eventuality might have a strong orientation towards security and therefore, I don't know, hide $20 bills in the bread box.
Yeah, I think that there probably is some correlation that you can draw there. And I think, you know, when you think about moms versus non-moms, I have a friend and I was like, I really would love to feature you. And she's like, Lindsay, I haven't carried a handbag in years. And she's single and is very busy with her business.
She's got a phone with a credit card on it.
She's got a phone with a credit card on it and she's ready to go. And I'm like, not even like a cute little, like, you know, when you're going out, come on. And I also think, there's this writer, financial expert, Manish Tokor, and I've been reading her book, Money Zen. And in it, she talks about her handbag collection and how that was a really big thing for her when she was in corporate finance. And I think the quality of the handbag also has a lot to do with a person and like what they value. It's funny, when I left my job last summer to go freelance, I had this backpack that I carried for years that I hated it. Mm. And when I finished the job, I was like, I'm done. I am selling this backpack on Poshmark. It is cursed. Enough. So we attach a lot of sentimentality to these bags that we carry everywhere. Mm.
There is something really powerful about looking at personal finance through the gender lens. There's, you know, some pros and cons to thinking about it in that way, but I think mostly pros. What are some things that you have learned over the course of the last couple of years that really resonate for women in a way that they might not resonate for men?
Yeah, I think, you know, we have a lot of challenges, you know, just like we're set up, we start behind men. There's a gender wage gap when we have children. There's a motherhood penalty. There's a retirement gap. There's an investment gap. So there's just all these big challenges to begin with. And then oftentimes women are not socialized to have these conversations about money. And so we're made to feel shamed if we ask for more. You know, we have weird conversations about like how we spend our money. There's a lot of judgment there. So I think that, you know, I'm trying to take away some of those taboos and make it more comfortable and make it fun and make it interesting. And it also tends to be like so jargony and like, I feel like there's a barrier to entry that doesn't need to exist. And that goes for like male or female, you know, I just think in general, personal finance advice should be more conversational and easier to understand and access.
I went to play pickleball. This is going to connect, I promise. I went to play pickleball with a female friend, and we decided we'd go from intermediate to advanced. Advanced was male-dominated, super intense, and they were like not having any fun. And I asked her, honestly, is this like what your world is like? And she said, 100%. She's a banker by background, walking into a male-dominated room. So there is lots that women can do to advocate for themselves, to you know, utilize their agency and all that. But what's the role for men in order to make the world more accommodating and more welcoming to women as it relates to personal finance?
That's a really great question. I think, you know, a big piece of it is just making sure women are part of the conversation. Are they at the table? Are you advocating for them to have fair pay? I remember many years ago, I had a conversation with a man and he was in charge of hiring two entry-level reporters and he had a certain amount of money to split between them. And he started offering them both like, you know, the same salary, and the woman took it and the young man asked for 10% more. And because he had negotiated the budget the way he was able to give that man 10% more. And he didn't go back to that woman and offer her more either. And that always really stuck with me. I think that, you know, when you're in charge of hiring, if you have these situations where you can be more transparent and say, you know, actually you should ask for 10% more. I've got 10% more in the budget for you. Yeah. Let me help you.
And or the guy doesn't get 10% because you can't do it across the board.
Yes, exactly.
And going back to this experience,
you give them both 5%. Sorry.
Sure. Going back to this experience with pickleball, I said, I'm a gay dude, but I'm a dude. I wake up and I put myself in advanced pickleball, whether it's merited or not. Whereas my friend is like, oh no, and she's a better player than I am. So there's a starting point at which there really is, and I'm sure the psychologists and sociologists have quantified this, that we greet the day very, very differently.
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, it's interesting that you're talking about that advanced pickleball and saying that the medium one was more fun. I think
so much more fun.
Like a piece of me is like, well, why can't we be good pickleball players playing moderately because it's more fun? Like, you know, it doesn't always have to be. I tend to sort of live in a bubble. My friends tease me sometimes because I like to surround myself with women. And most of the people that I talk to and experts I tap are women on purpose because it's more fun. And I hope that even though I do that, that doesn't mean that I'm like, you know, missing out on experiences or something like that. So I think, you know, it's okay for women to think about money differently than men. We don't have to be the same men. We can have different values and approach it differently. And, you know, even if we choose to be like less risk adverse, I think it's just like being aware and making those decisions with clarity.
You're time traveling. It's 5 years into the future. You look back and say, wow, I am so proud of what the purse accomplished in that time. what would be some examples of accomplishments you are proud of?
Oh, I mean, you know, it's really interesting that you ask that. When I was an editor at Refinery29, and while I was there, I was very, very into this idea of like salary transparency and talking about money. And I think, you know, it's been 5 years since then, and you see the conversations changing in so many ways. And I think that there's still a lot of work to do. And I imagine like 5 years in the future, like it's even more comfortable for women to talk about money. And we see like big shifts in the pay gap, like it starts closing, and like really great things, like there's better access to childcare in this country that's more affordable. And, you know, I would love a lot of people to read the purse. That would be awesome.
That would be great, too.
That would be great, yes.
And maybe you could have some guys unload on their purse.
I think I would definitely host some men sharing what's inside their purse. Yes. As long as, you know, men tend to be a little more tight-lipped about these things. So.
Oh, yeah. Well, I still apologize about my man purse, and it's mostly socially acceptable and very practical. Very
I'm sure. Practical. It's very practical.
Lindsay, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Bruce. This was so much fun.
Lindsay Stanbury is the founder of The Purse, and we hooked her in to talk about her In The Purse series, which is so great. It's when she actually has women open up their handbag and talk about what's inside it. But what I really value was these broader conversations we have about gender and money and the things that we can do. Ah, men, step up to push for more equality in this world. Coming up, an app for newcomers to Canada that connects them with cultural events in Canada, oftentimes for free. Daniel Bernard is the CEO of the Institute for Canadian Citizenship, and he'll be here to talk about the Canoe Access Pass. If you like food, fashion, culture, design, you'd love the TV show City Line. It is Canada's longest running daily lifestyle show. And I just happen to be the money columnist over there. So lucky. You can tune in live across Canada on City TV stations. You can also go to cityline.tv to watch some of the segments that we've done over the course of the last while. Very practical personal finance advice. Also kind of fun. Moolala Money Made Simple is brought to you in part by Credit Canada. I am the CEO of the organization, and we are Canada's longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency. Our mission is to help people get out of debt so they can get back into life. Listen, debt is a brutal reality for millions of Canadians. It starts to pile on for lots and lots of different reasons: job loss, divorce, illness, bad luck, you name it. Our accredited credit counselors are available to help you understand your current financial situation and take you through all your options on how to move forward. And there really are options out there. So go to creditcanada.com. We are nonprofit, as I said. The counseling is free and judgment free. We are very interested in the newcomer experience on this show. We have looked at, from a personal finance perspective, how they can get jobs, how they can get access to credit when they arrive in this country with no credit score. Today, we're going to focus on how they might be able to get some stuff for free. We're going to talk about a new app. It's called the Canoe Access Pass, C-A-N-O-O, haha. And it comes from the ICC, the Institute for Canadian Citizenship. Joining us now to talk about it is the CEO of the ICC, Daniel Bernard. Hello there.
Hello.
We are, newcomers is something we could talk about all day, every day, because it is so important to the future prosperity of our country. It also affects all aspects of Canadian life in terms of things like real estate and the labor market and all those sorts of things. But we're going to focus on the app. What was the problem that you were trying to solve?
Well, when my parents moved to Canada in the 1970s, their integration into society was based on who they knew. And they had some friends who lived here, and those friends made recommendations. Their ability to become Canadians in the fullest sense, not just workers and taxpayers, but citizens and people with friends and hobbies, that took a long time. And today, the cost of that time is very, very severe for Canada because our retention of skilled immigrants is declining. And so our view is that we need to make the decision to move to Canada not just desirable, but sticky and permanent. We don't want people to have any regrets. And so if they can have a great time here, watch their children smile, enjoy some iconically Canadian experiences, both culture experiences, nature experiences, then the decision to come to Canada will be stickier, and that will benefit not just newcomers in their early years, but also, as you said, all of Canada who benefit from the contributions that immigrants make. So the Canoe app gives new immigrants within their first 5 years as permanent residents free access to over 2,000 experiences, plus big discounts with big brands like Via Rail and Air Canada, concert tickets, sports tickets, you name it. All the things that make life in Canada worth living for everybody who's living here. It's an experiential welcome that so many corporations contribute to. It's a really fantastic and innovative Made in Canada program that's making this country a desirable place, not just to come, but to stay.
Is kind of a great intersection of nation building and marketing. Like, I'm sure the marketers are very happy to have a way to target this audience, both, you know, for-profit banks, but also the cultural institutions that you are promoting on the app. Tell us what, from a user perspective, what will they see when they download it? I downloaded it. You'll describe it better than I will.
I'll describe the ideal version and you can tell me what you actually found. When you download the app, you'll be able to see right away all of the different experiences that are available. And if you want to claim any of the discounts or the freebies, you'll need to scan a document that will allow us to verify your eligibility. So that'll either be your permanent resident card, front or back, or your citizenship certificate. If you've been a citizen for 12 months or fewer, then you're also eligible for Canoe. So the marketers love it. They love it because it's one of these areas where mission and margin are not intention. They're not competing forces. It's a way to give towards newcomers during an important phase of their lives, which helps them, which helps Canada by ensuring that they're welcome and integrated. And if you build lifelong lasting brand loyalty in the process, then all the better for it. And we're really, really happy. The Canoe Network, like I said, over 2,000 experiences provided by almost 500 different partner organizations. Wow. And that's something that we're able to do, to be a platform that all of corporate Canada, civil society, et cetera, can jump onto. Because if you really want to support newcomers in the country, how do you do that? It's actually not very easy to do, and we provide a mechanism to do that. So it's been definitely taking off amongst marketers.
And it's connected to the community in which you live. So I, as someone based in Toronto, was served up mostly stuff that is relevant within driving distance to me, but You'd find different things in other parts of the country. The one that struck me was it was a Toronto Symphony Orchestra free performance that they're going to record for something. So what it seems like is a lot of the things on offer aren't just available to everybody, but there's some other kind of spin or difference that the app brings to life. Is that accurate or was that a one-off?
No, that's absolutely accurate. I mean, we try to say that either the activity or the cost of accessing the activity has to be preferential for Canoe members in order for you to be on the app. So for example, Via Rail offers us a 50% standing discount for all of our members, for you and up to four attending people to go anywhere in Canada once. And that's something that's not available anywhere else. We have a standing discount with Air Canada that has similar properties. So our banking offer, for example, it's not for all Canoe members, but for a good large majority of them, have access to the group banking, CIBC group banking deal that you cannot get on the street. So we try to make sure that people are bringing their best stuff, and we don't just want to be another billboard showing people ads. We want to be providing real benefits, including from corporate partners that are trying to market and win over customers. The premise of our service is the same. This is full of gifts. This is a welcome basket. It's an experiential welcome provided by some of the most formidable and reputable institutions in Canada, corporate Canada, civil society, public sector, et cetera, who want to put their welcoming ethos into action. They do that via Canoe. And anyone who's new to the country, you can save thousands of dollars using this app. It's entirely free to join. We don't collect any payment, even if there's a discount that you have to pay for a ticket or whatever. That's between you and the people who provide the ticket. There's no credit card information disclosed or anything like that. We don't sell personal data. We don't sell programmatic ads. We're an idealistic organization. And as you said off the top, this is a great way to save thousands of dollars, including especially with kids' activities, which can sometimes get very expensive.
I noticed in one of the offers, there was a reference to you needing to be a year one user. Tell me more about how that works. The fresher you are to this country, there are different things.
Yeah, so Canoe's going through a transition right now. We used to be a 12-month pass, so you could sign up for Canoe and you'd activate your membership at a time of your choosing, and then a 12-month, one-year clock would start and you'd have the benefits for that year and then they'd be done. We've now been negotiating with several of our partners, and they're coming on stream gradually to offer the benefits for 4 years. It's the 100% off admission to the zoo or science centers or, you know, et cetera, for the first year. And then 50% in the second year, 25% in the third year, 15% in the fourth year. So your benefits will continue for longer. They'll become progressively less generous as you've been on the program, but at least it gives more people more time to discover more of Canada and fall in love with it. So that's a change that we've been making recently to make sure that these savings go even further.
There is a reference to volunteer opportunities. Tell me about that.
Well, integrating into society is about more than just getting experiences that you would otherwise have to pay for. Making friends and developing Canadian experience are really important. And we've actually found a very significant desire on behalf of newcomers to the country, maybe not on the very first day or in the first months, but after a year or two, to begin to build social capital and networks and make friends around volunteering. It's a very North American, I would say, thing to do, volunteering outside of the faith context. Of course, there are many people who volunteered in faith contexts all around the world, but outside of the faith context. And it's a great way to, like I said, build experience, make friends, build networks, and contribute back to the community, which has contributed in many cases a lot to you. So we make those opportunities available for youth in particular, but for anybody. If they're interested in getting involved, that's a way to do it. And it's not free work. It's not working for, you know, for free to get some kind of experience that you can later resell. It's really about the value to you and the network that you build and the social capital that you build.
Certainly, the ICC has a broader mandate than just this app and is an organization that a lot of Canadians don't know much about. What is the mission of the ICC and how does it work?
Yeah, so ICC, Institute for Canadian Citizenship, not International Criminal Court or Indian Cricket Council.
That's okay, clearly you've done some Google research to see what you can trademark and what you cannot.
Yeah, I mean, this was started before my time, but our goal is for immigrants to not just come, but to stay and to become citizens, not just in their passports, but in their hearts. And I'm a big believer that people from around the world have built Canada because they bought into this idea that in Canada, you're not a renter, so to speak, but you're an owner of the society. You don't just live here, but you can vote. You can stand for the highest office as an immigrant. Our founder, Adrian Clarkson, was a refugee who became the governor general, who became head of state. That's possible here. That's illegal in the United States, for example, and in many other countries. So in Canada, anyone who wants to become Canadian and buy in can make the fullest contributions and reap the fullest benefits of this country. Everything from the Chinese workers who built this impossible railroad through the mountains to our very first World Cup goal in the FIFA Men's World Cup, which was scored by Alfonso Davies, who's a refugee from Liberia, but who now wraps himself in the maple leaf when he goes to work every day. That's our ethos. We think that all of Canada benefits from it, and that's why we're able to rally all of Canada to provide these benefits. This is not about compassion for immigrants. Poor people, oh no, shouldn't you get some stuff for free? This is a VIP pass recognizing that people with new ideas and new potential from around the world bring renewal and prosperity and hope for our future. That's how it's always been, and that's how we hope it will continue to be.
Fantastic stuff. Thank you for joining us to talk about it.
Thanks for your time.
Daniel Bernard is the CEO of the Institute for Canadian Citizenship. That's it for our show today. A thanks to our sponsor, Credit Canada, first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country. If you have a comment, a suggestion, a story idea, anything you want to let us know about, please send an email to ask@moolala.ca. Our newsletter can be found at moolala.ca. Well, mostly the registration for the newsletter. If you want it, we send it once a month. And if you'd like to subscribe to this show, you can do so at any of the places where you listen to your podcasts. On social media, I am at Bruce Selry on X, Bruce Selry Moolala on Facebook. Thank you so much for listening, and have a great day.